for things that mystified or obstructed her, acquired virtues that were easy to maintain, assigned herself a role in the scheme of things, and harked back to simpler times for gratification. She took on the full responsibility and recognition of breadwinner and returned to church. First, however, she moved out of the two rooms into a spacious first floor of a building that had been built as a store. She came into her own with the women who had despised her by being more moral than they. She avenged herself on Charlie by forcing him to indulge in the weaknesses she despised. She joined a church where shouting was frowned upon, served on stewardess board number 3, and became a member of ladies' circle number 1. At prayer meeting, she moaned and sighed over Charlie's ways and hoped God would help her keep the children from the sins of the father. She stopped saying children and said children instead. She let another tooth fall and was outraged by painted ladies who thought only of clothes and men. Holding Charlie as a model of sin and failure, she bore him like a crown of thorns and her children like a cross. It was her good fortune to find a permanent job in the home of a well-to-do family whose members were affectionate, appreciative, and generous. She looked at their houses, smelt their linen, touched their silk draperies, and loved all of it. The child's pink nightie, the stacks of white pillow slips edged with embroidery, the sheets with top hems picked out with blue cornflowers. She became what is known as an ideal servant, for such a role filled practically all of her needs. When she bathed the little Fisher girl, it was in a porcelain tub with silvery taps running infinite quantities of hot, clear water. She dried her in fluffy white towels and put her in cuddly nightclothes. Then she brushed the yellow hair, enjoying the roll and slip of it between her fingers. No zinc tub, no buckets of stove-heated water, no flaky, stiff, grayish towels washed in a kitchen sink, dried in a dusty backyard. No tangled black puffs of rough wool to comb. Soon she stopped trying to keep her own house. The things she could afford to buy didn't last, had no beauty or style, and were absorbed by the dingy storefront. More and more, she neglected her house, her children, her man. They were like the afterthoughts one has just before sleep, the early morning and late evening edges of her day, the dark edges that made the daily life with the Fishers lighter, more delicate, more lovely. Here she could arrange things, clean things, line things up in neat rows. Here her foot flopped around on deep pile carpets, and there was no uneven sound. Here she found beauty, order, cleanliness, and praise. Mr. Fisher said, "I would rather sell her blueberry cobblers than real estate." She reigned over cupboards stacked high with food that would not be eaten for weeks, even months. She was queen of canned vegetables, bought by the case, special fondants, and ribbon candy curled up in tiny silver dishes. The creditors and service people who humiliated her when she went to them on her own behalf respected her, were even intimidated by her when she spoke for the Fishers. She refused beef slightly dark or with edges not properly trimmed. The slightly reeking fish that she accepted for her own family, she would all but throw in the fishman's face if he sent it to the Fisher house. Power, praise, and luxury were hers in this household. They even gave her what she had never had, a nickname, Polly. It was her pleasure to stand in her kitchen at the end of a day and survey her handiwork, knowing there were soap bars by the dozen, bacon by the rasher, and reveling in her shiny pots and pans and polished floors, hearing, "We'll never let her go. We could never find anybody like Polly. She will not leave the kitchen until everything is in order. Really, she is the ideal servant." Pauline kept this order, this beauty for herself, a private world, and never introduced it into her storefront or to her children. Them, she bent toward respectability, and in so doing taught them fear. Fear of being clumsy, fear of being like their father, fear of not being loved by God, fear of madness like Charlie's mother. Into her son she beat a loud desire to run away, and into her daughter she beat a fear of growing up, fear of other people, fear of life. All the meaningfulness of her life was in her work, for her virtues were intact. She was an active churchwoman, did not drink, smoke, or carouse, defended herself mightily against Charlie, rose above him in every way, and felt she was fulfilling a mother's role conscientiously when she pointed out their father's faults to keep them from having them, or punish them when they showed any slovenliness, no matter how slight, when she worked 12 to 16 hours a day to support them. And the world itself agreed with her. It was only sometimes, and then rarely, that she thought about the old days or what her life had turned to. They were musings, idle thoughts, full sometimes of the old dreaminess, but not the kind of thing she cared to dwell on. I started to leave him once, but something came up. Once, after he tried to set the house on fire, I was all set in my mind to go. I can't even remember now what held me. He sure ain't give me much of a life, but it wasn't all bad. Sometimes things wasn't all bad. He used to come easing into bed sometimes, not too drunk. I make out like I'm asleep 'cause it's late, and he taken $3 out of my pocketbook that morning or something. I hear him breathing, but I don't look around. I can see in my mind's eye his black arms thrown back behind his head, the muscles like great big peach stones sanded down, with veins running like little swollen rivers down his arms. Without touching him, I'd be feeling those ridges on the tips of my fingers. I seize the palms of his hands, calloused to granite, and the long fingers curled up and still. I think about the thick, knotty hair on his chest and the two big swells his breast muscles make. I want to rub my face hard in his chest and feel the hair cut my skin. I know just where the hair growth slacks out, just above his navel, and how it picks up again and spreads out. Maybe he'll shift a little, and his leg will touch me, or I feel his flank just graze my behind. I don't move, even yet. Then he lifts his head, turn over, and put his hand on my waist. If I don't move, he'll move his hand over to pull and knead my stomach, soft and slow-like. I still don't move because I don't want him to stop. I want to pretend sleep and have him keep on rubbing my stomach. Then he will lean his head down and bite my tit. Then I don't want him to rub my stomach anymore. I want him to put his hand between my legs. I pretend to wake up and turn to him but not opening my legs. I want him to open them for me. He does, and I be soft and wet where his fingers are strong and hard. I be softer than I ever been before. All my strength in his hand. My brain curls up like wilted leaves. A funny, empty feeling is in my hands. I want to grab hold of something, so I hold his head. His mouth is under my chin. Then I don't want his hand between my legs no more, because I think I am softening away. I stretch my legs open, and he is on top of me, too heavy to hold, and too light not to. He puts his thing in me, in me, in me. I wrap my feet around his back so he can't get away. His face is next to mine. The bed spring sounds like them crickets used to back home. He puts his fingers in mine, and we stretches our arms out wise, like Jesus on the cross. I hold on tight. My fingers and my feet hold on tight, because everything else is going, going. I know he wants me to come first, but I can't. Not until he does. Not until I feel him loving me, just me, sinking into me. Not until I know that my flesh is all that be on his mind, that he couldn't stop if he had to, that he would die rather than take his thing out of me, of me. Not until he has let go of all he has and give it to me, to me, to me. When he does, I feel a power. I be strong. I be pretty. I be young. And then I wait. He shivers and tosses his head. Now I be strong enough, pretty enough, and young enough to let him make me come. I take my fingers out of his and put my hands on his behind. My legs drop back onto the bed. I don't make no noise because the children might hear. I begin to feel those little bits of color floating up into me, deep in me, that streak of green from the June bug light, the purple from the berries trickling along my thighs. Mama's lemonade yellow runs sweet in me. Then I feel like I'm laughing between my legs, and the laughing gets all mixed up with the colors, and I'm afraid I'll come, and afraid I won't, but I know I will, and I do, and it be rainbow all inside, and it lasts and lasts and lasts. I want to thank him, but don't know how. So I pat him like you do a baby. He asks me if I'm all right. I say yes. He gets off me and lies down to sleep. I want to say something, but I don't. I don't want to take my mind off of the rainbow. I should get up and go to the toilet, but I don't. Besides, Charlie is asleep with his leg thrown over me. I can't move and don't want to. But it ain't like that anymore. Most times he's thrashing away inside me before I'm woke and through when I am. The rest of the time I can't even be next to his stinking drunk self. But I don't care about it no more. My maker will take care of me. I know he will. I know he will. Besides, it don't make no difference about this old earth. There is sure to be a glory. Only thing I miss sometimes is that rainbow. But like I say, I don't recollect it much anymore. See, Father, he is big and strong. Father, will you play with Jane? Father is smiling. Smile, Father. Smile. Smile. When Charlie was 4 days old, his mother wrapped him in two blankets and one newspaper and placed him on a junk heap by the railroad. His great-aunt Jimmy, who had seen her niece carrying a bundle out the back door, rescued him. She beat his mother with a razor strap and wouldn't let her near the baby after that. Aunt Jimmy raised Charlie herself, but took delight sometimes in telling him of how she had saved him. He gathered from her that his mother wasn't right in the head, but he never had a chance to find out, because she ran away shortly after the razor strap, and no one had heard of her since. Charlie was grateful for having been saved, except sometimes. Sometimes when he watched Aunt Jimmy eating collards with her fingers, sucking her four gold teeth, or smelled her when she wore the asfetida bag around her neck, or when she made him sleep with her for warmth in the winter, and he could see her old, wrinkled breasts sagging in her nightgown. Then he wondered whether it would have been just as well to have died there, down in the rim of a tire, under a soft, black Georgia sky. He had 4 years of school before he got courage enough to ask his aunt who and where his father was. "That Fuller boy, I believe it was," his aunt said. "He was hanging around then, but he'd taken off pretty quick before you was born. I think he'd gone to Macon, him or his brother, maybe both. I hear old man Fuller say something about it once." "What name he have?" asked Charlie.
"Fuller, foolish.
I mean, what his given name?" "Oh." She closed her eyes to think and sighed. "Can't recollect nothing no more. Sam, was it?"
"Yeah, Samuel."
No, it wasn't. It was Samson. Samson Fuller. "How come you all didn't name me Samson?" Charlie's voice was low.
"What for? You was nowhere around when you was born. Your mama didn't name you nothing. The 9 days wasn't up before she throwed you on the junk heap. When I got you, I named you myself on the 9th day. You named after my dead brother, Charles Breedlove, a good man. Ain't no Samson never come to no good end." Charlie didn't ask anything else. 2 years later, he quit school to take a job at Tyson's Feed and Grain Store. He swept up, ran errands, weighed bags, and lifted them onto the drays. Sometimes they let him ride with the drayman, a nice old man called Blue Jack. Blue used to tell him old-timey stories about how it was when the Emancipation Proclamation came, how the black people hollered, cried, and sang, and ghost stories about how a white man cut off his wife's head and buried her in the swamp, and the headless body came out at night and went stumbling around the yard, knocking over stuff because it couldn't see, and crying all the time for a comb. They talked about the women Blue had had, and the fights he'd been in when he was younger, about how he talked his way out of getting lynched once, and how others hadn't. Charlie loved Blue. Long after he was a man, he remembered the good times they had had. How on a July 4th, at a church picnic, a family was about to break open a watermelon. Several children were standing around watching. Blue was hovering about on the periphery of the circle, a faint smile of anticipation softening his face. The father of the family lifted the melon high over his head. His big arms looked taller than the trees to Charlie, and the melon blotted out the sun. Tall, head forward, eyes fastened on a rock, his arms higher than the pines, his hands holding a melon bigger than the sun, he paused an instant to get his bearing and secure his aim. Watching the figure etched against the bright blue sky, Charlie felt goose pimples popping along his arms and neck. He wondered if God looked like that. No, God was a nice old white man with long white hair, flowing white beard, and little blue eyes that looked sad when people died and mean when they were bad. It must be the devil who looks like that, holding the world in his hands, ready to dash it to the ground and spill the red guts so niggers could eat the sweet, warm insides. If the devil did look like that, Charlie preferred him. He never felt anything, thinking about God, but just the idea of the devil excited him. And now the strong black devil was blotting out the sun and getting ready to split open the world. Far away, somebody was playing a mouth organ. The music slithered over the cane fields and into the pine grove. It spiraled around the tree trunks and mixed itself with the pine scent, so Charlie couldn't tell the difference between the sound and the odor that hung about the heads of the people. The man swung the melon down to the edge of a rock. A soft cry of disappointment accompanied the sound of smashed rind. The break was a bad one. The melon was jagged, and hunks of rind and red meat scattered on the grass. Blue jumped. "Oh," he moaned, "there go the heart." His voice was both sad and pleased. Everybody looked to see the big red chunk from the very center of the melon, free of rind and sparse of seed, which had rolled a little distance from Blue's feet. He stooped to pick it up. Blood red, its planes dull and blunted with sweetness, its edges rigid with juice. Too obvious, almost obscene, in the joy it promised. "Go ahead, Blue," the father laughed. "You can have it." Blue smiled and walked away. Little children scrambled for the pieces on the ground. Women picked out the seeds for the smallest ones and broke off little bits of the meat for themselves. Blue's eye caught Charlie's. He motioned to him. "Come on, boy. Let's you and me eat the heart." Together, the old man and the boy sat on the grass and shared the heart of the watermelon, the nasty sweet guts of the earth. It was in the spring, a very chilly spring, that Aunt Jimmy died of peach cobbler. She went to a camp meeting that took place after a rainstorm, and the damp wood of the benches was bad for her. For 4 or 5 days afterward, she felt poorly. Friends came to see about her. Some made chamomile tea, others rubbed her with liniment. Miss Alice, her closest friend, read the Bible to her. Still she was declining. Advice was prolific, if contradictory. "Don't eat no whites of eggs. Drink new milk. Chew on this root." Aunt Jimmy ignored all but Miss Alice's Bible reading. She nodded in drowsy appreciation as the words from 1 Corinthians droned over her. Sweet amens fell from her lips as she was chastised for all her sins, but her body would not respond. Finally, it was decided to fetch Madeer. Madeer was a quiet woman who lived in a shack near the woods. She was a competent midwife and decisive diagnostician. Few could remember when Madeer was not around. In any illness that could not be handled by ordinary means, known cures, intuition, or endurance, the word was always, "Fetch Madeer." When she arrived at Aunt Jimmy's house, Charlie was amazed at the sight of her. He had always pictured her as shriveled and hunched over, for he knew she was very, very old. But Madeer loomed taller than the preacher who accompanied her. She must have been over 6 feet tall, four big white knots of hair gave power and authority to her soft black face. Standing straight as a poker, she seemed to need her hickory stick not for support, but for communication. She tapped it lightly on the floor as she looked down at Aunt Jemmy's wrinkled face. She stroked the knob with the thumb of her right hand while she ran her left one over Aunt Jemmy's body. The backs of her long fingers she placed on the patient's cheek, then placed her palm on the forehead. She ran her fingers through the sick woman's hair, lightly scratching the scalp and then looking at what the fingernails revealed. She lifted Aunt Jemmy's hand and looked closely at it. Fingernails, back skin, the flesh of the palm she pressed with three fingertips. Later she put her ear on Aunt Jemmy's chest and stomach to listen. At Medea's request, the woman pulled a slop jar from under the bed to show the stools. Medea tapped her stick while looking at them. "Bury the slop jar and everything in it," she said to the women. To Aunt Jemmy, she said, "You done caught cold in your womb. Drink pot liquor and nothing else." "Will it pass?" asked Aunt Jemmy. "Is I'm gonna be all right?" "I reckon." Medea turned and left the room. The preacher put her in his buggy to take her home. That evening, the women brought bowls of pot liquor from black-eyed peas, from mustards, from cabbage, from kale, from collards, from turnips, from beets, from green beans, even the juice from a boiling hog jowl. 2 evenings later, Aunt Jemmy had gained much strength. When Miss Alice and Mrs. Gaines stopped in to check on her, they remarked on her improvement. The three women sat talking about various miseries they had had, their cure or abatement, and what it helped. Over and over again, they returned to Aunt Jemmy's condition, repeating its cause, what could have been done to prevent the misery from taking hold, and Medea's infallibility. Their voices blended into a trinity of nostalgia about pain. Rising and falling, complex in harmony, uncertain in pitch, but constant in the recitative of pain. They hugged the memories of illnesses to their bosoms. They licked their lips and clucked their tongues in fond remembrance of pains they had endured. Childbirth, rheumatism, croup, sprains, backaches, piles, all of the bruises they had collected from moving about the earth, harvesting, cleaning, hoisting, pitching, stooping, kneeling, picking, always with young ones underfoot. But they had been young once. The odor of their armpits and haunches had mingled into a lovely musk. Their eyes had been furtive, their lips relaxed, and the delicate turn of their heads on those slim black necks had been like nothing other than a doze. Their laughter had been more touch than sound. Then they had grown, edging into life from the back door, becoming everybody in the world was in a position to give them orders. White women said, "Do this." White children said, "Give me that." White men said, "Come here." Black men said, "Lay down." The only people they need not take orders from were black children and each other. But they took all of that and recreated it in their own image. They ran the houses of white people and knew it. When white men beat their men, they cleaned up the blood and went home to receive abuse from the victim. They beat their children with one hand and stole for them with the other. The hands that fell trees also cut umbilical cords. The hands that wrung the necks of chickens and butchered hogs also nudged African violets into bloom. The arms that loaded sheaves, bales, and sacks rocked babies into sleep. They patted biscuits into flaky ovals of innocence and shrouded the dead. They plowed all day and came home to nestle like plums under the limbs of their men. The legs that straddled a mule's back were the same ones that straddled their men's hips, and the difference was all the difference there was. Then they were old, their bodies honed, their odor sour, squatting in a cane field, stooping in a cotton field, kneeling by a riverbank. They had carried a world on their heads. They had given over the lives of their own children and tendered their grandchildren. With relief, they wrapped their heads in rags and their breasts in flannel, eased their feet into felt. They were through with lust and lactation, beyond tears and terror. They alone could walk the roads of Mississippi, the lanes of Georgia, the fields of Alabama unmolested. They were old enough to be irritable when and where they chose, tired enough to look forward to death, disinterested enough to accept the idea of pain while ignoring the presence of pain. They were, in fact, and at last, free. And the lives of these old black women were synthesized in their eyes, a puree of tragedy and humor, wickedness and serenity, truth and fantasy. They chattered far into the night. Charlie listened and grew sleepy. The lullaby of grief enveloped him, rocked him, and at last numbed him. In his sleep, the foul odor of an old woman's stools turned into the healthy smell of horse shit, and the voices of the three women were muted into the pleasant notes of a mouth organ. He was aware, in his sleep, of being curled up in a chair, his hands tucked between his thighs. In a dream, his penis changed into a long hickory stick, and the hands caressing it were the hands of Madeir. On a wet Saturday night, before Aunt Jemmy felt strong enough to get out of bed, Essie Foster brought her a peach cobbler. The old lady ate a piece, and the next morning, when Charlie went to empty the slop jar, she was dead. Her mouth was a slackened O, and her hands, those long fingers with a man's hard nails, having done their laying by, could now be dainty on the sheet. One open eye looked at him, as if to say, "Mind how you take hold of that jar, boy." Charlie stared back, unable to move, until a fly settled at the corner of her mouth. He fanned it away angrily, looked back at the eye, and did its bidding. Aunt Jemmy's funeral was the first Charlie had ever attended. As a member of the family, one of the bereaved, he was the object of a great deal of attention. The ladies had cleaned the house, aired everything out, notified everybody, and stitched together what looked like a white wedding dress for Aunt Jemmy, a maiden lady to wear when she met Jesus. They even produced a dark suit, white shirt, and tie for Charlie. The husband of one of them cut his hair. He was enclosed in fastidious tenderness. Nobody talked to him, that is. They treated him like the child he was, never engaging him in serious conversation. But they anticipated wishes he never had. Meals appeared, hot water for the wooden tub, clothes laid out. At the wake, he was allowed to fall asleep, and arms carried him to bed. Only on the third day after the death, the day of the funeral, did he have to share the spotlight. Aunt Jemmy's people came from nearby towns and farms. her brother, O.V., his children and wife and lots of cousins. But Charlie was still the major figure, because he was Jimmy's boy, the last thing she loved, and the one who found her. The solicitude of the women, the head pats of the men, pleased Charlie, and the creamy conversations fascinated him. What'd she die from?
Essie's pie.
Don't say. Uh-huh. She was doing fine. I saw her the very day before. Said she wanted me to bring her some black thread to patch some things for the boy. I should have known, just from her wanting black thread, that was a sign. Sure was. Just like Emma, remember? She kept asking for thread. Dropped dead that very evening. Yeah. Well, she was determined to have it. Kept on reminding me. I told her I had some to home, but no, she wanted it new. So I sent little June to get some that very morning when she was laying dead. I was just fixing to bring it over, along with a piece of sweetbread. You know how she craved my sweetbread. Sure did. Always bragged on it. She was a good friend to you. I believe it. Well, I had no more got my clothes on when Sally bust in the door hollering about how Charlie here had been over to Miss Alice, saying she was dead. You could have knocked me over, I tell you. Guess Essie feels mighty bad. Oh, Lord, yes. But I told her, the Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. Wasn't her fault, none. She makes good peach pies. But she bound to believe it was the pie did it. And I spec she right. Well, she shouldn't worry herself none about that. She was just doing what we all would have done. Yeah, 'cause I was sure wrapping up that sweetbread. And that could have done it, too. I doubt that. Sweetbread is pure. But a pie is the worst thing to give anybody ailing. I'm surprised Jimmy didn't know better. If she did, she wouldn't let on. She would have tried to please. You know how she was. So good. I'll say. Did she leave anything? Not even a pocket handkerchief. The house belongs to some white folks in Clarksville. Oh, yeah? I thought she owned it. May have at one time, but not no more. I hear the insurance folks been down talking to her brother. How much do it come to? $85, I hear. That all? Can she get in the ground on that? Don't see how. When my daddy died last year this April, it costed $150. Of course, we had to have everything just so. Now, Jimmy's people may all have to chip in. That undertaker that lays out black folks ain't none too cheap. Seems a shame. She's been paying on that insurance all her life. Don't I know? Well, what about the boy? What's he gonna do? Well, can't nobody find that mama. So Jimmy's brother gonna take him back to his place. They say he got a nice place, inside toilet and everything. That's nice. He seems like a good Christian man. And the boy needs a man's hand. What time's the funeral? 2:00. She ought to be in the ground by 4:00. Where's the banquet? I heard Essie wanted it at her house. No, it's at Jimmy's. Her brother wanted it so. Well, it will be a big one. Everybody liked old Jimmy. Sure will miss her in the pew. The funeral banquet was a peal of joy after the thunderous beauty of the funeral. It was like a street tragedy with spontaneity tucked softly into the corners of a highly formal structure. The deceased was the tragic hero, the survivors the innocent victims. There was the omnipresence of the deity, strophe and antistrophe of the chorus of mourners led by the preacher. There was grief over the waste of life, the stunned wonder at the ways of God and the restoration of order in nature at the graveyard. Thus, The banquet was the exaltation, the harmony, the acceptance of physical frailty, joy in the termination of misery, laughter, relief, a steep hunger for food. Charlie had not yet fully realized his aunt was dead. Everything was so interesting. Even at the graveyard, he felt nothing but curiosity. And when his turn had come to view the body at the church, he had put his hand out to touch the corpse to see if it were really ice cold, like everybody said. But he drew his hand back quickly. Aunt Jimmy looked so private, and it seemed wrong, somehow, to disturb that privacy. He had trudged back to his pew, dry-eyed, amid tearful shrieks and shouts of others, wondering if he should try to cry. Back in his house, he was free to join in the gaiety, enjoy what he really felt, a kind of carnival spirit. He ate greedily and felt good enough to try to get to know his cousins. There was some question, according to the adults, as to whether they were his real cousins or not, since Jimmy's brother, O.V., was only a half-brother, and Charlie's mother had been the daughter of Jimmy's sister, but that sister was from the second marriage of Jimmy's father, and O.V. was from the first marriage. One of these cousins interested Charlie in particular. He was about 15 or 16 years old. Charlie went outside and found the boy standing with some others near the tub where Aunt Jimmy used to boil her clothes. He ventured a tentative, "Hey." They responded with another. The 15-year-old named Jake offered Charlie a rolled-up cigarette. Charlie took it, but when he held the cigarette at arm's length and stuck the tip of it into the match flame, instead of putting it in his mouth and drawing on it, they laughed at him. Shamefaced, he threw the cigarette down. He felt it important to do something to reinstate himself with Jake. So when he asked Charlie if he knew any girls, Charlie said, "Sure." All the girls Charlie knew were at the banquet, and he pointed to a cluster of them, standing, hanging, draping on the back porch. Darlene, too. Charlie hoped Jake wouldn't pick her. "Let's get some and walk around," said Jake. The two boys sauntered over to the porch. Charlie didn't know how to begin. Jake wrapped his legs around the rickety porch rail and just sat there staring off into space as though he had no interest in them at all. He was letting them look him over and guardedly evaluating them in return. The girls pretended they didn't see the boys and kept on chattering. Soon their talk got sharp. The gentle teasing they had been engaged in with each other changed to bitchiness, a serious kind of making fun. That was Jake's clue. The girls were reacting to him. They had gotten a whiff of his manhood and were shivering for a place in his attention. Jake left the porch rail and walked right up to a girl named Suki, the one who had been most bitter in her making fun. "Want to show me around?" He didn't even smile. Charlie held his breath, waiting for Suki to shut Jake up. She was good at that, and well known for her sharp tongue. To his enormous surprise, she readily agreed, and even lowered her lashes. Taking courage, Charlie turned to Darlene and said, "Come along, we're just going down to the gully." He waited for her to screw up her face and say no, or what for, or some such thing. His feelings about her were mostly fear that she would not like him, and fear that she would. His second fear materialized. She smiled and jumped down the three leaning steps to join him. Her eyes were full of compassion, and Charlie remembered that he was the bereaved. "If you want to," she said, but not too far. Mama said we got to leave early, and it's getting dark. The four of them moved away. Some of the other boys had come to the porch and were about to begin that partly hostile, partly indifferent, partly desperate mating dance. Suki, Jake, Darlene, and Charlie walked through several backyards until they came to an open field. They ran across it and came to a dry riverbed lined with green. The object of the walk was a wild vineyard where the muscadine grew. Too new, too tight to have much sugar, they were eaten anyway. None of them wanted, not then, the grape's easy relinquishing of all its dark juice. The restraint, the holding off, the promise of sweetness that had yet to unfold excited them more than full ripeness would have done. At last, their teeth were on edge, and the boys diverted themselves by pelting the girls with the grapes. Their slim, black boy wrists made G-clefs in the air as they executed the tosses. The chase took Charlie and Darlene away from the lip of the gully, and when they paused for breath, Jake and Suki were nowhere in sight. Darlene's white cotton dress was stained with juice. Her big blue hair bow had come undone, and the sundown breeze was picking it up and fluttering it about her head. They were out of breath and sank down in the green and purple grass on the edge of the pine woods. Charlie lay on his back, panting, his mouth full of the taste of muscadine, listening to the pine needles rustling loudly in their anticipation of rain. The smell of promised rain, pine, and muscadine made him giddy. The sun had gone and pulled away its shreds of light. Turning his head to see where the moon was, Charlie caught the sight of Darlene in moonlight behind him. She was huddled into a D, arms encircling drawn-up knees on which she rested her head. Charlie could see her bloomers and the muscles of her young thighs. "We bet get on back," he said. "Yeah." She stretched her legs flat on the ground and began to retie her hair ribbon. "Mama gonna whoop me." "No, she ain't." "Uh-huh. She told me she would if I get dirty." "You ain't dirty." "I am too. Look at that." She dropped her hands from the ribbon and smoothed out a place on her dress where the grape stains were heaviest. Charlie felt sorry for her. It was just as much his fault. Suddenly he realized that Aunt Jimmy was dead, for he missed the fear of being whipped. There was nobody to do it, except Uncle O.V., and he was the bereaved, too. "Let me," he said. He rose to his knees facing her and tried to tie her ribbon. Darlene put her hands under his open shirt and rubbed the damp, tight skin. When he looked at her in surprise, she stopped and laughed. He smiled and continued knotting the bow. She put her hands back under his shirt. "Hold still," he said. "How I gonna get this?" She tickled his ribs with her fingertips. He giggled and grabbed his rib cage. They were on top of each other in a moment. She corkscrewing her hands into his clothes, he returning the play, digging into the neck of her dress and then under her dress. When he got his hand in her bloomers, she suddenly stopped laughing and looked serious. Charlie, frightened, was about to take his hand away, but she held his wrist so he couldn't move it. He examined her then with his fingers, and she kissed his face and mouth. Charlie found her muscadine-lipped mouth distracting. Darlene released his head, shifted her body, and pulled down her pants. After some trouble with the buttons, Charlie dropped his pants down to his knees. Their bodies began to make sense to him. and it was not as difficult as he had thought it would be. She moaned a little, but the excitement collecting inside him made him close his eyes and regard her moans as no more than pine sighs over his head. Just as he felt an explosion threaten, Darlene froze and cried out. He thought he had hurt her, but when he looked at her face, she was staring wildly at something over his shoulder. He jerked around. There stood two white men, one with a spirit lamp, the other with a flashlight. There was no mistake about their being white. He could smell it. Charlie jumped, trying to kneel, stand, and get his pants up, all in one motion. The men had long guns. Hee-hee! Hee-hee! The snicker was a long, asthmatic cough. The other raced the flashlight all over Charlie and Darlene. Get on with it, nigger, said the flashlight one. Sir, said Charlie, trying to find a buttonhole. I said get on with it, and make it good, nigger, make it good. There was no place for Charlie's eyes to go. They slid about furtively, searching for shelter, while his body remained paralyzed. The flashlight man lifted his gun down from his shoulder, and Charlie heard the clop of metal. He dropped back to his knees. Darlene had her head averted, her eyes staring out of the lamplight into the surrounding darkness and looking almost unconcerned, as though they had no part in the drama taking place around them. With a violence born of total helplessness, he pulled her dress up, lowered his trousers and underwear. Hee hee, hee hee hee. Darlene put her hands over her face as Charlie began to simulate what had gone on before. He could do no more than make believe. The flashlight made a moon on his behind. Come on, coon, faster. You ain't doing nothing for her. Charlie, moving faster, looked at Darlene. He hated her. He almost wished he could do it, hard, long, and painfully. He hated her so much. The flashlight wormed its way into his guts and turned the sweet taste of muscadine into rotten, fetid bile. He stared at Darlene's hands, covering her face in the moonlight. They looked like baby claws. Hee hee, hee hee hee. Some dogs howled. That's them, that's them. I know that's old honey. Yep, said the spirit lamp, come on. The flashlight turned away and one of them whistled to honey. Wait, said the spirit lamp, the coon ain't come yet. Well, he'll have to come on his own time. Good luck, coon baby. They crushed the pine needles underfoot. Charlie could hear them whistling for a long time, and then the dog's answer, no longer a howl, but warm, excited yelps of recognition. Charlie raised himself and in silence buttoned his trousers. Darlene did not move. Charlie wanted to strangle her, but instead he touched her leg with his foot. We gotta get, girl. Come on. She reached for her underwear with her eyes closed and could not find them. The two of them padded about in the moonlight for the panties. When she found them, she put them on with the movements of an old woman. They walked away from the pine woods toward the road, he in front, she plopping along behind. It started to rain. That's good, Charlie thought. It will explain away our clothes. When they got back to the house, some 10 or 12 guests were still there. Jake was gone. Suki, too. Some people had gone back for more helpings of food. Potato pie, ribs. All were engrossed in early night reminiscences about dreams, figures, premonitions. Their stuffed comfort was narcotic and had produced recollections and fabrications of hallucinations. Charlie and Darlene's entrance produced only a mild stir. "Y'all soaked, ain't you?" Darlene's mother was only vaguely fussy. She had eaten and drunk too much. Her shoes were under her chair, and the side snaps of her dress were open. "Girl, come on in here. Thought I told you." Some of the guests thought they would wait for the rain to slacken. Others, who had come in wagons, thought they'd best leave now. Charlie went into the little storeroom, which had been made into a bedroom for him. Three infants were sleeping on his cot. He took off his rain and pine-soaked clothes and put on his coveralls. He didn't know where to go. Aunt Jimmy's room was out of the question, and Uncle Ovi and his wife would be using it later anyway. He took a quilt from a trunk, spread it on the floor, and lay down. Somebody was brewing coffee, and he had a sharp craving for it just before falling asleep. The next day was cleaning out day, settling accounts, distributing Aunt Jimmy's goods. Mouths were set in downward crescents, eyes veiled, feet tentative. Charlie floated about aimlessly, doing chores as he was told. All the glamour and warmth the adults had given him on the previous day were replaced by a sharpness that agreed with his mood. He could think only of the flashlight, the muscadines, and Darlene's hands. And when he was not thinking of them, the vacancy in his head was like the space left by a newly pulled tooth, still conscious of the rottenness that had once filled it. Afraid of running into Darlene, he would not go far from the house, but neither could he endure the atmosphere of his dead aunt's house, the picking through her things, the comments on the condition of her goods. Sullen, irritable, he cultivated his hatred of Darlene. Never did he once consider directing his hatred toward the hunters. Such an emotion would have destroyed him. They were big, white, armed men. He was small, black, helpless. His subconscious knew what his conscious mind did not, that hating them would have consumed him, burned him up like a piece of soft coal, leaving only flakes of ash and a question mark of smoke. He was in time to discover that hatred of white men, but not now. Not in impotence, but later, when the hatred could find sweet expression. For now, he hated the one who had created the situation, the one who bore witness to his failure, his impotence, the one whom he had not been able to protect, to spare, to cover from the round moon glow of the flashlight. The hee-hee-hees. He recalled Darlene's dripping hair ribbon, flapping against her face as they walked back in silence in the rain. The loathing that galloped through him made him tremble. There was no one to talk to. Old Blue was too drunk too often these days to make sense. Besides, Charlie doubted if he could reveal his shame to Blue. He would have to lie a little to tell Blue, Blue the woman killer. It seemed to him that lonely was much better than alone. The day Charlie's uncle was ready to leave, when everything was packed, when the quarrels about who gets what had seethed down to a sticking gravy on everybody's tongue, Charlie sat on the back porch waiting. It had occurred to him that Darlene might be pregnant. It was a wildly irrational, completely uninformed idea, but the fear it produced was complete enough. He had to get away. Never mind the fact that he was leaving that very day. A town or two away was not far enough, especially since he did not like or trust his uncle, and Darlene's mother could surely find him, and Uncle O.V. would turn him over to her. Charlie knew it was wrong to run out on a pregnant girl, and recalled, with sympathy, that his father had done just that. Now he understood.